Tonight on Arena, we look back at the best of our film and television interviews from the last 12 months. Well, 2020 has been a landmark year for so many reasons. The pandemic led to the sudden closure of cinemas and in turn, distributors and studios making big decisions to either pull planned releases or to give them to us digitally. It also led to television and more specifically prestige television drama finding an even bigger, more appreciative audience. Tonight, I'll be looking back at some of the big interviews we did here on Arena from the great and the good of film, and first of all, television. Just in the last few months, The Undoing gripped the hearts and minds of whodunit lovers the world over. And shortly, I'll bring you my interview with writer Jean Hanf-Korelitz and her husband, the poet Paul Muldoon. But to start, the first event television of the year, Normal People, which stole our hearts in the first lockdown. I spoke to Oscar-nominated director Lenny Abrahamson in April, and I began by asking how he came across Sally Rooney's book.
Yeah, well, so I work very closely with Element Pictures in Dublin, have done for many, many years, and with Ed Guiney and Andrew Lowe in there. And Ed said, read this, it's amazing. He got an early copy of the book before publication, and he felt it would be something that I'd respond to, and I did for sure. I think what struck me about it is just this unusual kind of combination of writing which seems very direct and simple. You know, like Sally writes with such kind of precision and clarity, and without obvious literary flourish, but at the same time you feel that she brings you somewhere very deep. And particularly creates this sense of intimacy with the characters, both between the characters and you know, between the reader and the characters. And I was kind of really floored by it and felt very moved by it, and also felt that it was a story I hadn't really seen told recently, particularly, you know, unbalanced a very positive story about the power of intimacy and the capacity of young people to experience really life-changing things at a stage in their life where some you know, contemporary screen storytelling tends to kind of either make it a joke or make it too glossy. This was just a very truthful and real account of a very profound relationship.
Absolutely. I had the great good luck to get to watch some preview episodes of the series. I had to beat myself up the stairs last night way too late. I wanted to watch another two episodes, but I said, no, I have to go to bed or I won't be able to get up in the morning. What really struck me was what you talk about, the intimacy is so important in this entire realization. It is there in Sally Rooney's book. Absolutely, you're correct. But it's the intimacy, it's the fragility of the relationship between Marianne and Connell, as played by your astonishing cast, Paul Mescal and Daisy Edgar Jones. It's the fragility that they manage to portray. You feel that if they even spoke a decibel louder, the whole thing could shatter and it could all fall desperately, go desperately wrong. It really is a delicate piece.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, I mean, I just have to give such credit to the two of them. They are absolutely extraordinary. I mean, people say that a lot about people that they work with, and therefore it's hard to distinguish sometimes the kind of the truly extraordinary from the kind of really good. But they are truly extraordinary. They're two amazing young actors. Like Paul, this is his first screen role. You know, he was a very, very well regarded young theatre actor in Dublin, but this was his first screen role. And Daisy has done television, but in smaller roles. So it was a huge sort of move for them, and they just absolutely grabbed hold of these two characters and bring such kind of depth and poetry to them. And I think that's it. You know, when you've got a story which is in some senses quite small, you know, like the events aren't massively dramatic, from you take 10 steps back and they just look like two young people talking to each other, you know, and breaking up and making up the way people do. But you step in close enough and you realize just how momentous those experiences are. But that won't play for an audience unless you've got actors who are capable of embodying the characters and presenting them with that kind of subtlety and emotional truthfulness. And then I think we just tried, and I you know, my way of working is just try to really observe what's happening kind of as honestly as I can and make it feel to the audience that they're watching an unmediated kind of, they're having an encounter with these people in an unmediated way. And I think if you can achieve that and tune right in, then there is this feeling that you are watching something so fragile and potentially so amazing, and you're watching them misstep here and there and then occasionally mm-hmm. find each other and lose each other. And it's kind of emotionally very powerful on this quite small scale when you step back from it.
Well, let's listen to a clip that gives us a real sense of that, as you say, both small scale and enormous scale that seem to coexist. Connell, played by Paul Mescal, Marianne, played by Daisy Edgar-Jones. And earlier in the day, or in a previous scene, she has been speaking to him and he asks her about what she meant when she said that she liked him.
You know, you were saying the other day that you like me. By the photocopier, you said it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you mean like as a friend or what?
No. Not just as a friend.
Yeah, I thought that might be implied. I just wasn't sure. See, I'm just a little confused about what I feel. I think it'd be awkward in school if something happened with us.
No one would have to know. That was nice.
All right, what are you laughing for?
Nothing.
Well, you're acting like you've never been kissed before.
I haven't.
Don't tell anybody in school about this, okay?
Like I talk to anyone at school.
I'm almost afraid to speak at the end of that clip from Normal People, Lenny Abrahamson, director, speaking with me about it this evening. Paul Mescal playing Connell there. Daisy Edgar-Jones playing Marianne. It's their first kiss. They're teenagers, you know, as you say.
Yeah.
Not a momentous world event, but in their worlds, a momentous event.
Yeah.
I just wonder how you got that atmosphere, though, Lenny, on set. That they could achieve that kind of beautiful intimacy, beautiful fragility. And I mean, I was both smiling and almost crying listening to them there, even though I watched it last night and did the same two things.
You know, it's sort of a combination of things, I think. You know, it's great writing and great adaptation by Sally herself and this wonderful British screenwriter and playwright called Alice Birch, who wrote the script for Lady Macbeth recently. That was a great film, British film. And we all worked very closely on that to create sort of very naturalistic scenes, but ones which were full of thoughtful kind of intensity without being too dramatic. So a certain kind of quietness really helps, I think. And then I worked with Daisy and Paul over on and off over many weeks before we started shooting, not kind of intensive rehearsal, which can sometimes, you know, kind of tire things out a little bit, but just talking about where they were coming from in various parts of the story and working on a kind of language, a physical language between them. And so that was a scene which we worked on quite a bit and went through various subtle changes in the work. And it's really an accumulation of detail in the preparation and then like not being afraid of silences and quiet and thoughtfulness in the execution. But it is interesting because I haven't listened to that audio only. I know that scene obviously incredibly well, having lived with it for a year. But it is interesting how even in the audio, you can feel that delicacy and that fragility. And it is a sort of magic and hard to know how it is that those things all come together. But sometimes they do. And it's just so exciting when it happens.
Lenny Abrahamson there. And if Normal People was the must-see show of the first lockdown, then The Undoing, starring Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant, was definitely the show of the second. No binging allowed on this one. It was an old-fashioned week-by-week release, adapted by the master of television drama, David E. Kelly, from Jean Hanf Korlitz's novel, You Should Have Known. Jean spoke to me last month from New York, along with her husband, the poet, Paul Muldoon. And I began by asking Jean about the original characters of Grace and Jonathan that she wrote about in her novel.
Well, they are somewhat different characters. There are major differences between the characters in the novel and the characters in the adaptation. Probably the most important difference is that my characters are all Jewish, and they're not anymore in the TV show. But you know, that's a change. I'm at peace with all the changes. I mean, yeah. I'm okay with. I think when you submit your work for adaptation, you can't control what happens. It's the meeting of minds between, you know, what you've done and the person who's going to take it from there. So that's okay. But plenty of differences. Another major difference is that they're not all that wealthy in my book. They're certainly wealthy by global standards, but in the cartography of New York City money, they are poor. And that's a big issue for them because they're living among super wealthy people. So it's interesting to see them, in this stratosphere of money. And you may or may not know that the house in which they filmed a lot of The Undoing has just been put on the market for something like $30 million. And there's rich and then there's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Yes.
Do you think that it being involved in the series, the house added to the value or subtracted from the value?
I think it did, and I was able to see the inside of the house during one filming day. And I got to tell you, you know, I always knew just before I saw any of it that when it aired, it was going to be about the house, the hair, and the coats. I mean, these were the three things that people were going to be obsessed about, and I was right about all three. Yeah. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous house.
Yeah, it certainly is, and there are lots of gorgeous outfits, it has to be said, that those very wealthy people wear throughout the episodes that I've seen so far. At any rate, so once you were you involved with David E. Kelly then at all, other than saying, look, David, you do make the changes you want. I know you've told me he changed the characters from being Jewish. He changed them from being, you know, relatively, I suppose, probably okay to being incredibly rich. But did you just have to put that to bed and say, no, it's fine?
Well, I didn't even ever consider saying anything at all. It's fine or it's not fine. I mean, this is David E. Kelly. I mean, I've been watching his book since I was, you know, in my 20s. Yeah. He's a master. What am I going to do? I say, no, you can't do that. You're wrong. Don't touch it. I mean, it would be, I was thrilled when David E. Kelly wanted to adapt the book. Yeah. And I wouldn't have dreamed of telling him what to do, even if I did not philosophically believe that it is the adapter's role to adapt. Yeah.
Well, I suppose, Paul, if I could bring you probably could tell us what the truth is about those changes, probably late one or other evening over a couple of glasses of wine. There may have been very frank discussions. Had you read the novel, Paul, before the adaptation started to happen?
I had indeed. And actually, no, Jean, this is Jean's, what Jean has just said to you is really how she feels about it. And I think it's very important when one gives one's work over or allows one's work to be taken over for adaptation to let it go. You know, another intelligence is at work there. And Jean, of course, had the experience of having one of her earlier novels adapted for as a film. And that was Admission with Tina Fey. And again, you know, they take the core of the story in many cases and use it as a jumping off point. I mean, I suppose my big regret, I suppose, in all of this is that I'm still waiting for one of my poems to be made into what I call a miniseries.
you say that the rights are going cheap in case anybody out there wants.
Well, let us, before we get into what them not being made into miniseries, I suppose adapting a poem is a whole different ballgame. But we did have the theatrical adaptation of Incantata from the Galway Arts Festival a couple of years back, Paul, which was, you know,
that poem. Yeah.
Well, that's right. And again, you know, I was thrilled that they were interested in it at all, and that indeed they did such a fabulous job. And, you know, it becomes something else. It's not so obvious, perhaps, with a poem as it is with a novel or a drama. But a poem, when others begin to read it, it enters another realm in which the person through whom it was written, and in some cases myself, has really little or no role, perhaps none, and has no more say than the next person in the street. But I mean, the one thing I was very happy about, and vis-a-vis You Should Have Known, was that insofar as there is some question as to whether or not the character played by Hugh Grant is somewhat based on myself. you know, I mean, I suppose that people are given sustenance in that belief by the fact that Hugh Grant was chosen to play me,
oh,
as it
were. He's absurd. Paul.
Yeah, I think the big difference that I noticed, Paul, was clearly he doesn't have curly hair and glasses. Apart from that, I was totally gone on the fact that it was based on you.
Well, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, all art is autobiographical, but perhaps I'd say no more about that and hand back to my wife, whose show this is.
No, I mean, I can tell you exactly where the character came from, if it's of any interest. I'm a devoted reader of New York Magazine, one of the great magazines in the world. I've been reading it since I was a teenager, and they have this special issue every year with the best doctors in New York. And one year there was an interview with a pediatric oncologist, and he was, not a young, handsome guy at all, it didn't matter what he looked like. But what he said was that it was a privilege to be allowed into people's lives at their absolute worst moment of their lives. And I, you know, that was a very warm and kind of beautiful thing to say. But I found myself thinking, what if you were the kind of person who craved that drama and that intensity, and that you went towards that emotion, but you had no compassion, real compassion of your own? If you were a sociopath and a doctor, that is exactly the kind of field you would enter. Mm. And then I happened to know a pediatric oncologist who I felt was a less than savory human being. And I kind of combined these two people together, and I made Jonathan.
And that was novelist Jean Hanf Corlitz. You're welcome back to Arena's 2020 film and TV special. This year, we were lucky to speak to two giants of independent cinema who also dabble in mainstream projects. German auteur Werner Herzog spoke to us about his 2020 release, Family Romance, LLC. But first, here's actor Stellan Skarsgård, who appears in The Painted Bird, which was released this autumn. I began by asking Stellan about reading the book on which the film is based by the Polish author Jerzy Kaczynski.
Yes, but that's many years ago. I remember the feeling of having read it. I didn't remember the details, but I remember it was I thought it was a really good book. And when the director approached me 11 years ago and told me, I got the rights after 2 years of fighting, I got the rights to Jerzy Kosinski's book. Will you be in it? He said to me. And I knew I couldn't play the boy, so I knew it was just a small role. But I said yes, of course, because it's the kind of film you want to be made, because of they don't make films like that very often.
Yeah, well, and the nature of the film, you've given part of it to us there, in that if you're not the small boy, it's a series of vignettes, a series of scenes which features this small boy going from village to village, place to place, household to household, in fact, in some ways, and they are short encounters with 15, maybe 20 different characters, and you play one of those characters. So you say that the book had spoken to you in some way. You didn't remember the detail of it, but what was the atmosphere then? Because if it was still there somewhere in your subconscious or in your consciousness, what was it that you remembered about the novel?
Well, it's one of those very brutal stories about human nature and human life that stays with you. And it was hard to forget the book. Like, I think it's hard to forget the film once you've seen it.
Mm. And the brutality, is that what was that the thing that was to the fore in your memory?
Yeah. Violent is not pleasant in that world, and it's not pleasant in our world either. It is pleasant in most Hollywood films, but that's a lie.
Your character, however, Hans, this German soldier, is one of the few that actually, he's not really violent towards him, even though he could be if he wanted to be.
Spoiler alert. I mean, it's important that someone nice in the film or does something. I mean, he does it, or rather refrains from being nasty to the boy. It's more of what he does not do than what he does, isn't it?
Talk to me about the actor who plays the character of that young boy, because he was the one who was there for the entire shoot, whereas all of you guys came in for maybe a day or a couple of days.
Well, he was in the, I mean, they shot the film over 2 years. So he was in for 2 years. I was in for 2 days. So we had very different experiences, of course. But he grew throughout the film. So they shot it in the right order. So you can actually see on screen. You can see him grow. He's fantastic in the film. His name is Peter Coulter, and he's fantastic in the film. And the director treated him in a wonderful way. He was protected from the worst things, basically very often by that they shot him and his reaction separately from what he saw. But he was very concentrated and very brave. And acting with him was great, because his presence was so strong in the scene. So you didn't have to do much. You just had to look at him, basically.
And as we say in this particular film, The Painted Bird, no words at all and very little dialogue throughout more or less the 3 hours of the film. Couldn't be more different when it comes to, I think, the recent TV series that people will really remember you in, the series Chernobyl. There were a lot of words for all of you in that, but particularly for you as the Russian politician. What was that experience like? A very different experience, I would guess, from The Painted Bird?
No, it's totally different. No, Chernobyl was, of course, something else. It was a more normal construction of a TV series, but it was extremely well written. And it was about 104 fantastic actors that they had hired, mostly British. So it was a fantastic cast. We shot it in Lithuania, and we never went to the real Chernobyl. We went to another RMBK reactor that was shut down in Lithuania, but most of it was built sets. I had a great time on it.
And I guess if there was a chemistry that had to be achieved very quickly between yourself and Peter Kotlar in The Painted Bird, there was a different type of chemistry that had to be achieved over a longer period of time between yourself and Jared Harris, who was playing the character of the scientist in the Chernobyl television series. How did that relationship grow? Because I've seen you in several interviews with him where you seem to have a great laconic sense of humor between the two of you.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. But it is, if you look at on the paper, the relationship is not written really, which means that, as always, I mean, my way of acting is usually not in the line. It is between the lines. And that's where I thrive, and I want as little dialogue as possible, but I don't think Chernobyl would have worked as well if we hadn't had that kind of relationship that we created between us, that moves back and forth, and that starts very antagonistic and then grows and becomes very intimate towards the end. And that is not in the text. That is in how we play the scenes. And that we, the fantastic thing with the camera is it sees what you think or what you feel. It picks up things and it's small movements, everything. And all this is transferred to the audience, but never explained. So you can actually feel that there is a relationship without it being even spoken about.
I'm wondering, you living in Sweden at the time, were you there at the time of the explosion or of the accident in Chernobyl? And what was the kind of atmosphere? Because you're so close by, I guess, Stellan.
Yeah, well, first we heard it that they thought it that was because they had detected some radiation at one of our nuclear plants, and they thought there might be a leak. And then they realized that that kind of radiation did not come from their fuel. And so they realized that they came from Chernobyl because of the winds. The winds went straight from Chernobyl over Sweden, mainly north of Stockholm, and poisoned, really poisoned the forest north of Stockholm. Because still 50% of the wild boar you shoot in the north of Sweden has to be just thrown away because it's there's too many becquerels in it. But it wasn't panic or anything. You know, we Swedes, we don't panic easily. As you know, we didn't even do a lockdown for Corona now. So it was pretty calm. But it was, in many ways, it was an eye opener because a lot of people realized how enormous the consequences could be if something goes wrong in a nuclear reactor.
I'm just wondering, I know the last time we spoke, I think it was back in 2014, and you mentioned that your wife listens to Irish radio in the morning time. You met in Dublin. In fact. Do you still do that? Does she still do that?
She still does it. I know about the traffic situation at Stephen's Green every morning.
Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Stellan.
Okay, thank you. It was a pleasure. Yeah. Take care.
Hey, Roadwatch, eat your heart out. Stellan Skarsgård there. And now to Werner Herzog, who spoke to us in July about his film Family Romance LLC, which is about imposters who stand in for real people. And Herzog told me about his own pale imitators at the start of our interview.
Thank you very much, but you should be careful, of course. When you look in the internet, there's about, there's a number, maybe 30, 40 imposters. People who pretend to be me on the social media. I'm not member of Facebook or Twitter or any of this. However, there's a Twitter account, a Facebook account, and they give you advice about life as if they were the real Werner Herzog. It's kind of funny, and representation of self in the age of internet, of course, has new qualities and new things that we have to absorb and we have to get acquainted to.
And in fact, it's very much at the heart of the themes and the ideas that you're exploring, I think, in the new movie Family Romance LLC, based on a real company, as I said, operating in Japan. Tell me how you came across this company, if you would, Werner. And also, you know, what it offered to you as a filmmaker. You must have been very excited when you heard about it.
Well, I heard about it through a former student of mine. I founded a film school, The Rogue Film School, which is some sort of a guerrilla-style film school against all the nonsense that's being done worldwide in film schools. You learn a few things in my film school, for example, how to break safety locks or how to forge documents like a shooting permit and things like that. So, and one of these young men, Rock Morin, he does very interesting films, but he's also a good writer. And I said, don't ignore writing, keep on writing as well. He sent me an article he'd written about Family Romance, this real company in Japan. I knew this was so big. It was incredible. And I got in touch with him and he said, you must make a film. And he didn't feel ready. He had the feeling somebody else should do it. And I said, well, I'd love to do it. Shall we do it together? He would be producer, I would be writer and director. So that's how it happened. And it's so authentic in a way. It has such a true tone to it that some people believe it's a documentary. But of course, everything is scripted. Everything is directed. Everything is acted. Every scene is rehearsed. So it's a quintessential feature film.
And I suppose one of the reasons, or one of the many reasons that people might confuse it with a documentary film, is the fact that Yuichi, your main character here, Yuichi Ishii, he is actually playing at least some kind of version of himself. He runs this company called Family Romance in Tokyo, where basically they send out people who pretend to be a family member, maybe at a wedding celebration, or just so that you can take a picture and put it up on your social media and say, look at all the great time I'm having with my family members, with these people pretending to be your family members. He plays himself, or a version of himself. Just explain to us how that works and how you came across casting him, how you came to casting him. Yeah.
It was never my intention to cast him, but I had two things. I had a small contract with Yuichi Ishii, and I said to him, two things I would like to do. Tell me, in one afternoon, tell me about events in your business life when you are renting out friends to people who live in great solitude, when you are renting out a missing family member for a wedding or so. So he told me stories, but what is in the film is almost completely, and 85-90% is my own invention. Some of it go back to very, very events. Second thing I wanted to hear from Yuichi Ishii was help me with casting. And since his company rents out up to, I think they have 1,500 today, probably 2,000 employees that they would rent out to play roles. And during two casting sessions that we had, he was behind the camera with me, and he was feeding the potential actors in such an intelligent and lively way. And so good in his intonations. So I said to him, I turned around after an hour or so, and I said, there's nobody better than you playing the leading part, and you have to play the leading part. And he said, oh, well, I'm not prepared to do that, and am I really an actor? And I said, well, cinema needs, it's a normal profession, and it needs certain people like a cinematographer, it needs a director, and I'm the director, and I know how to make somebody a real good actor who has never acted before. He plays roles, that's his business. But of course, he sends out 1,500 other people from his agency. So it's nothing completely foreign. Mm. And much of what we do is also in a way performative. When you are serving in the army, for example, it's performative. Much of it in business life is performative. When you are at a wedding, it's very, very performative with roles. So it's not foreign to us, and it's a strange thing that we have to all of a sudden reflect about how much are we performative.
You, I heard you speaking in an interview, I think you referred to yourself as wanting to be remembered as a good soldier of cinema, and that you were holding an outpost that all the others have abandoned already. What has been abandoned, do you think, in the world of cinema? What is that outpost that you're holding on to so strongly to keep it alive and to help it survive?
Well, when you look at the film industry and the absence of deep storytelling, which has been replaced mostly by spectacular special effects, explosions, car crashes, you just name it, but a deeper look into our own existence, into our own human condition, is largely absent, and very few are into that. But it's more than that. It's a new vocabulary, a new grammar of filmmaking, new imagery. So I've always been after that, but when I say good soldier, I also mean a sense of duty. I mean loyalty to an audience. I mean courage, real courage to do. In the film Family Romance, in many other of my films, required quite a lot of courage. In this case, I did it out of my own pocket. I financed it and I jumped into a situation that was completely unknown. I wanted to return to my early filmmaking, where, for example, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, where I'm floating down with Spanish conquistadores on rafts. But we literally did not know what was coming after the next bend of the river. Would there be a waterfall? Or would there be a village or whatever? So this kind of spirit of exploration, of going ahead, advancing without securities and a safety net.
Yeah, which is also, I suppose, the same type of journey that you took with Fitzcarraldo.
Yes, in many other films, sure, of course.
What about the acting side of life? I suppose the most recent thing that I saw was the Mandalorian, the spin-off to the Star Wars series. Were you familiar with Star Wars at all before this spin-off option to be the actor in this came to you?
No, I was not, and I still am not. But it's strangely enough, it kicked up a lot of dust in the internet. There were millions of comments about this and also insults. How can he play a character in The Mandalorian and hasn't seen any of the Star Wars films? So what? So what? But the internet is very strange. It has massive reactions to the most unexpected, to the most banal. It's a banality that I have not seen Star Wars. So what?
But if one of your actors arrived on set and said, oh yeah, I know the scene I'm in, but I haven't looked at any of the rest of the script, you mightn't be too happy with them, would you?
No. Let's put it in a different way. Any actor who had never seen any of my films and was not familiar with how I'm working and what I'm doing, so what? Fine.
Yeah, you'd be okay with that.
It would be a great no. And let's face it, I'm fairly good when it comes to the demonology of the true villain in movies. I'm always pretty good.
You like the villain part?
I was very scary in other parts that I played. Jack Reacher, for example. Yeah. I'm truly scary, and I like everything that has to do with cinema: writing, directing, editing. Just everything.
Yeah, and acting obviously as well is in there. Werner, it's been great to speak with you this evening. Thank you so much for your generosity and for your time.
And my best wishes to your country, Ireland, that's close to my heart, and best wishes to everyone who speaks Gaelic.
Well, Goramila Mahagat, Werner Herzog, and Shin a Kointlum, Imi Ul Shokacha. And you're welcome back to ARENA's 2020 Film and TV Special. Well, we're deep into the decade of commemorations now, and in November, the centenary of Bloody Sunday was marked with a special ceremony in Croke Park. We spoke to Neil Jordan, whose film, Michael Collins, has the events of Bloody Sunday at its dramatic core. And I put it to Neil that he certainly didn't shy away from the brutality of what happened on that day.
I mean, you have to realize that this kind of assassination was a shocking thing in the history of warfare, I suppose, really, and definitely in the history of the resistance to British imperial experience, really, because, I mean, it was the most brutal tactic that he decided on, you know, and I think at the time it shocked the world, you know, and sadly it became almost routine, you know, in terms of the use of guerrilla warfare and stuff like that, you know. But yeah. I was asked to make the movie by David Putnam, you know, and I knew very little about Collins. This was many years ago, around 1972, and I began to read the biographies of him. And at the start, I thought, this is a most unpleasant character, you know. I thought, you know, the level of brutality and the willingness to engage in that kind of brutality was kind of shocked me, really. And then I began to read more about about the period and about the you know, about the kind of you know, the delay of the Home Rule Act, you know, during the First World War, and you know, all of that sort of stuff. And I thought, okay, there might be a really interesting movie to be made about somebody who is willing to use that kind of brutality in quite a, you know, as a political weapon. And in the end, that's why I made the film.
Yeah, and then I guess, and then when you get Liam Neeson to play that part, and then the way you wrote the part as well, that we have to have an empathy, or at least some kind of understanding of this man, to want to watch the film for two and a bit hours.
I've actually just finished a novel on Lord Edward Fitzgerald, you know, in the 1798 period, and you realise that the kind of use of informants was almost like corrosive through the entire of the entire resistance to the empire in an earlier period, you know. And the one thing Collins did was he dealt with that issue very effectively. Well, he began to use the kind of the informant weapon against the Dublin Metropolitan Police and against the G-men in the castle and stuff like that. So, I mean, he was a very effective operator, really.
And if the assassinations initially were brutal, what happened in Croke Park subsequently was even more brutal.
Yes, it was very brutal. It was, yeah. I mean, I at the time I was criticised for using what people described as a tank. It actually wasn't a tank. It was actually an armored Rolls-Royce car, you know. And I'm just refreshing myself on the events before we did this interview. And actually, there were four lorries, you know, filled with auxiliaries, and there were two armored cars of those Rolls-Royce car. Those Rolls-Royce type. Now, I had one crash the gates and enter the grounds of Croke Park, you know, and the main reason for that was because I wanted the audience and the GAA players themselves to react with incredulity to the presence of this thing on their pitch, you know, to laugh at it, really, you know. And I suppose we also built, we couldn't afford, obviously, to build the entire Croke Park, and Croke Park was a new thing by that stage. So we had to adapt the Bray Wanderers premises out in Bray, and we had to redesign it. But we had two stands, really, and it was very kind of limited perspectives, you know. So I couldn't stage an event where the entire of the spectators and the entire of the match was surrounded by, you know, kind of armed men, you know, in different places, you know. And but it did happen, and you know, 30 people were both killed and injured during this that horrific particular afternoon. You know, yeah. So
the other thing
is being a movie, one does have to you know, make the events work for, you know, for the dynamism of the drama. And another reason I wanted to use that vehicle was because towards this, in the second half of the movie, when Collins has to act against his own forces, he is given exactly these pieces of artillery and these weapons, you know, those armed vehicles to use against the irregulars in the forecourts, you know. So that became part of the symbolism of the movie and part of the kind of logic of it.
Yeah, there's the echo of the forecourts, as you say, with Collins, and even it echoes the events of the GPO in some ways as well, when we see the forces attacking, and it also echoes that moment in Bloody Sunday. But again, today, you know, when you review something, you realise the things that you missed or that you viewed differently the first time you saw it. In my memory, the Bloody Sunday scene was much longer, and there was much more that went on. But in fact, it's maybe 30, 45 seconds long. It's quite short.
It's very short. It's very short. And I did want to make it short. I wanted to make it short and short and shocking and brutal, nasty, brutal and short, really, and move on to the aftermath very quickly, you know. There's many inaccuracies in the Michael Collins movie, but actually the one that kind of I regret the most was at the very start, when we see the GPO being blasted to bits by the British Army, the person who emerged with the white flag, I had a man, and in fact, it was a member of Cumann na mBan who came out and you know, presented the surrender kind of thing to General Maxwell or whoever it was. At the time, I didn't know that, you know. I only found out subsequently, but I would have loved to have a woman come out and do that and perform that act, you know.
Neil Jordan there. And now to the acclaimed Polish filmmaker Agnieszka Holland, who has just been elected president of the European Film Association and who was with us on Arena in February last. We spoke about many things, including her work on award-winning TV series like The Wire, The Killing and House of Cards. And I asked Agnieszka to what degree she thought TV drama had been elevated in the last 10 years.
I think that it's more than a decade, actually. I think it will be like 15, 20 years by now when it started. The like good, ambitious, you know, complex television of high quality and the innovative approach and, you know, interesting subjects. I think that it was somehow, it was response to several needs. One was that the cinema of the middle, as I call it, it means the cinema which in accessible way is speaking about the important complex issues has a very personal voice of the filmmaker, that the cinema practically vanished, changing the cinema started to be or very commercial or very, very remote, a bit like made for festivals more than for the general audience. And in this empty place, suddenly, you know, the ambitious television started to grow. And it took the place of the cinema, which was so important and popular in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s still of the 20th century. So that is the one reason. And another reason is that because our reality became more and more complicated, the short film doesn't have enough of space to develop the characters, to develop the reality description, and that the people started to feel the need for some epical dimension. It's very similar to what happened in 19th century during the Industrial Revolution, when the reality was so complicated that the big novel, you know, which actually was mostly printed by the weekly newspapers, by the
installments.
Episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So similar to...
And this need, it's similar to those series. Unfortunately, now I think that this golden age probably is like, it's not so gold anymore. I think that we are a bit of victims of the success, and suddenly so many series, so many platforms, it's such a competition, you know, to do something fast with the stars, with, you know, it goes in the similar direction like the successful American cinema in the 80s of last century. Suddenly, you know, the actors are paid the fortune, and one episode of the show, which costed, I don't know, half of the £1 million, you know, before, it's now costing five millions or even more. So yeah. I'm a little worried about the future.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was the fact that no women have been nominated for Best Director in this year's Oscars. Now, you have been nominated in the past for Best Foreign Language Film. But what do you make of that, of the reality that we have no female director in that list of nominations this year?
Well, it will change, you know. But
do you believe it will change?
Yeah, it will.
How? What will make it change?
Economy, you know, because for 100 years it was men who was ruling, you know, the industry, and it's very few women which made it into the, you know, mainstream future cinema. So the choice for the nomination is quite limited, you know. If you have 100 films made by men and 5 films made by women, it is difficult to compete. But the main reason why it was so, and why, for example, the male stars are paid twice as female stars, it was because, you know, the distributors believed that the men, it's men, it's boys, it's young men, it's husbands who are deciding which film they want to see, and the women are following. And when we are reading the last statistics from last 2-3 years, we see that the change is revolutionary, that the that the female main character are more popular, more people is going to the cinema to see female male main character than male main character. It means that now the young women are deciding what they want to see, and they want to see something which refers to them, which they can identify with. And this change of, it means they are buying more tickets also. It means that this change of the, you know, of the preferences and economical business like reasons will change also the access of the female producers, screenwriters and directors. And when we will be many, we will win.
I'm not going to ask you to put a date on it, but how long will you need to hold on to that optimism for equality of representation, equality of pay, equality of nomination, equality across the board? How long do you think you'll have to wait?
Step by step, I think probably 10 years. In 10 years, I'm afraid that I will be obliged to defend the male rights.
I'll wait for that interview. Okay. Agnieszka, it's lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Agnieszka Holland there. And that's all we have time for this evening. My thanks to producer Sinead Egan. On tomorrow's show, we'll be looking back at the best of culture from 2020 with our panel of critics. Join us at 7:00.